Hello. Whoa. Hello, everyone. That's not good. Maybe not 2 inches. Yeah, yeah. Sounds good. Can you hear me? Welcome to the third event in the... what quarter is it?
Winter.
Winter quarter. It's hard to remember. New writing series. I'd like to remind you to turn your cell phones off or down to a impossible to hear degree. Thanks for coming out, and thanks to the Dean of Arts and Humanities and to the Sims Family Trust for their generous support of our series, and thanks to the Mandeville Special Collections Library in over there in the Seuss Library, in the Geisel Library, for doing this, recording these readings and putting them on as podcasts on the website. And I would like to introduce Mandy Martin Sandino with her introduction for Renee Glattman. So, come on.
Good evening. The author of 4 books of prose, 1 work of poetry, 2 going on 3 novels, pamphlets, and critical essays, editor of Leon Works, an independent press for experimental prose and other thought projects based on the sentence, and a professor in the prestigious literary arts program at Brown University, Renee Glattman is perhaps best described as a multitasking genius. I've also just been told that she is the first publisher of the glorious Anna Joy Springer. Born in Atlanta, Georgia, Glattman received her BA in philosophy from Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, and a master's degree in poetics from the New College of California in the Bay Area. She currently resides in Providence, Rhode Island, another new change. Event Factory is the first in a trilogy of novels that Renee Glattman is writing about the invented city-state of Ravika, a foreign other place fraught with the crises of American urban experience, not least of all the fundamental problem of how to move through the world. The second volume of Glattman's trilogy continues her profound meditation upon translation and the ephemeral. She is currently at work on the third novel, Houses of Ravika. Ravika and Glattman's use of architectural human concepts to create the city-state have been described by Tom de Bouchon as a kind of curated environment, one built of the culture, language, and architecture of its people, but one that recognizes as well that the reader's perspective needs not be omniscient, that the reader's point of view can be directed, that the reader can be pulled into the fictive space and made to occupy the stage as an absence or an extra. Consciousness and self-consciousness drive the Ravika trilogy, such that the blending and confusing of perspective is complete. As readers, we are not simply listeners or voyeurs, but participants and confidants. We are aware of the narrator's insecurities that seem to speak as the author's insecurities. Yet in the space of linguistic construction and deconstruction, even we are made authors of the book with a satisfying transformation from I to you. From the Ravikians, it is dramatic and wonderful and isolating to present your work before an audience. Dramatic because you must connect with the piece you are reading, even if at present you do not. So you project your voice to cover the weakness. Wonderful because you remember to breathe in from your navel region, but isolating when you forget to blow out. Then you are breathing twice as hard as you would were you using normal breaths. Isolating, looking out for the eyes and smile that are not there. Wonderful to translate the eyes you do not get into the eyes you want. And on that note, please welcome the wonderful Renee Glattman.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that beautiful intro. She put you guys on a spot, which means you should be smiling the entire time and reading to encourage me. Because we all need encouragement. It's really great to be here. None of you were here when I was last here. No, you were. Many of you were probably in elementary school, but I taught at UCSD for a quarter in 2003, so it's really nice to be back. I haven't been back since. How else am I? Okay. So I am going to, there was a lot about Ravika in the intro, so I will read a little bit from the second book. I insist that Ravika is not a fiction, but it's very hard to convince other people, people otherwise, that this place does exist. If you Google it, there's a couple entries now. But I'm going to start with, I mean, that's really the mark of existence. If you can come up with something on Google, it's like, okay, she's right. It is a place. This spring, past spring, I started a manuscript called Calamities, which is a collection of essays I am writing, essays, otherwise known as ditties. And they came out of a couple impulses. One was I had been writing a lot of fiction and was feeling that I was tired of writing about things. The third book in the series is really tough for me because it has a suspense factor, which requires plotting, and I don't like those kinds of things. So I wanted to write about nothing. So I decided I would start writing essays about nothing. And then I also thought I had made some really big choices in my life, becoming a college professor, moving to this little isolated silly city, and that I hadn't really processed it in my work or in my thinking. So I wanted to sort of actually kind of work on the aspects of my life that were feeling very intense but kind of unexplored. So I'm going to read a few of these, and then see how much time I have left over, and then I'm going to read parts of the Ridiculous. So this is from Calamities, not in any particular order. In fact, the first one is page 32. They all begin with the same four words, and I hope that's not going to be a problem. I began the day reading the third section of Eileen Miles's Inferno. I was in heaven and had only been awake a short time and was reading, still in bed, on my side. I hadn't yet had coffee, so after a line or so of a book, my eyes would close. I would be sleeping, except also reading. The book would continue in my mind as I slept. How much time passes in this state? Then I'd wake all of a sudden and the book would have fallen onto the floor. It wasn't a high bed, or would be sitting in an impossible angle in my hand. I would write the book and try to find my place. The lines I'd been reading would not be there. Where had I gotten them? They continued the story perfectly, but not, it turned out, in the direction Eileen wanted it to go. Why not? My additions were not terrible, and they seemed bodily connected to her text. And what's further, they stayed with me as I went on reading, mingling with the lines that actually were there. I woke up again. I was thinking this and not reading the page I was reading, and I didn't quite know what I was thinking, though it made sense with what had been on my mind before I fell asleep. I had been talking about how your mind writes what you read and lays it out only one or two steps ahead of you, so that there's always a risk of taking a step that isn't yet there. The thing is, when you write essays about nothing, you don't have to really finish them because they're not about anything. So many of these just kind of drop off. I began the day looking up at the whiteboard, wondering how I would do this thing I needed to do. My students were waiting, Robert Frost was their contemporary picture of poetry. I didn't think this would help them with Ed Roberson. I was going to try to draw a grid of light as if one were looking down upon it, a grid that extended across an opaque surface, then draw a good distance below that a container inside which were symbols. From the lower container, I wanted to draw lines that reached the opaque surface, then became the actual lines of the grid. I would call those lines emanations. Without being essentialist, or perhaps being only momentarily so, I wanted to say, often when reading poetry, it's the grid you're experiencing. And the grid is not the same thing as that subterranean container where some meaning might lie, the actual story of the poem. Rather, it's the shape of the emanations refracted through language and feeling, though many contemporary poems have no feeling, that you're reading. I didn't know how to draw the effect of looking down on something, so I asked for a volunteer. Someone tall offered. And as I was looking up at his attempt to look down, I realized that there was a flaw to my thinking. The place from which the emanations arose was not intact. It was not a container wherein lay meaning. It was a grid itself, but of what I could not explain with the allotted time. I had to let the class go. It was 3:51, 1 minute into their free time. I couldn't find my words. They remained sitting there. How could I send them off to read Roberson's without having explained poetry to them? There is a grid above and a grid below, I said slowly, trying not to uplift my voice into a question. Perhaps to read poetry was to read through a sieve. I wanted to incorporate the idea of a matrix. Poetry comes out of nothing, I said, opening something I would never be able to close. 3:52. Read the nothing, I shouted after them as they walked out the door. That day didn't go well. These are true stories. I began the day considering the possibility that the person I am before I set my eyes upon the page I'm about to read, in this case page 79 of Herzog Müller's The Appointment, is entirely different than the person I am once I commence reading. I know this because I am not Eastern European in my real life. At least I can't get anyone to think of me this way. I can't get anyone to understand how the black person is another kind of Eastern European, especially the Eastern Europeans. I can't get black people to want to be anything other than black people, which on one hand is a great example of racial pride, but on the other hand keeps them from thinking that they are like Eastern Europeans. But being like and being another kind of, I realized as I somehow went on reading Müller, following the description of the narrator's most recent summons from a suspicious government official, I realized that being alike is not the same as being another kind of. How eventful it would be for the Eastern Europeans to begin calling themselves black, or even black Asian. How undermining of all that is the case for me to begin writing in my bios, Renee Gladman is an Eastern European African American. I would do this only to understand myself more as a reader. For example, why I pick my nose as I read, and why I yell out words I've never heard before. Calamities, these are all calamities. I began the day on an Amtrak train that was backing up. New England had flooded once again and become impassable. We just pulled into the station heading east toward Providence. It was New Haven. I was very interested in people watching, although it was dusk and these were Connecticut commuters who were bustling from the train across from us, not terribly exciting. Yet I was drawn to how the colors of their clothing passed by as a light rain wet the platform. I was counting reds and navy and grays when I realized that we hadn't yet resumed our journey. I turned to my companion, whose face since her arrival to the United States had become set with disappointment. It was May, and everyone, in particular tourists, expected it to be hot in this part of the country. where what you had instead was a wet, perpetually cold feeling in the air. A voice came on. Apparently the tracks had flooded. We needed to remain here. No, we needed to detrain and wait for buses in the station. No, the station was too crowded and we should remain on the train. No, half in the station, half on the train. No, finally it was decided all on the train. My fellow passengers had grown tired and all tried to get into the cafe car at once. The voice came on again to say that the cafe car was closed. We were in a predicament. I hadn't moved. I hadn't become thirsty. There was some math I needed to figure out. New England was becoming the Pacific Northwest. To be more specific, the Atlantic Northeast was becoming the Pacific Northwest, and quickly. First, I had to figure out what would happen to the Pacific Northwest once we had become it. It couldn't be that both northern ends of the opposite coast would have twin weather systems. There was no place in logic for that. So if we were to become the Pacific Northwest, then the Pacific Northwest would have to undergo its own transformation. Obviously, the Pacific Northwest would not become the former Atlantic Northeast, because we could have just stayed what we were, if that were possible. No, it would be something more along the lines of declension, something being less than it was before, which was why I was doing math and not paying much attention to the conductor's voice, which was, if anything, loud and New England in nature. You had to understand the enormity of the problem. It would not be simply that the former Atlantic Northeast was now the Pacific Northwest, but that the environment, the people, how they called themselves, the structures they built, would have to change as well. You could be the new Pacific Northwest, but still behave as if you were the former Atlantic Northeast, which technically you still were in terms of geography, but your climate would make your landscape unrecognizable. So what will happen to the New England personality? That was what I was trying to figure. It was not so good right now. It was tight, shut in like winter, but all year round. So I was trying to understand what happened to a bad personality when the conditions in which it lived became worse, and couldn't help wondering why the former Atlantic Northeast wasn't always the new Pacific Northwest with the way people behaved. I mean, they really did act like all there was rain. I thought about sharing this with the tourist, but she'd just taken my hand and put it on the hem of her skirt. It was determined that we would move ahead, but with the innovation of moving backward first. I began the day asking the individuals of this, one question, so there's a Q&A. Can you really go on and on saying I began the day and then have an essay and then start over again? So I really would like to know. I began the day asking the individuals of this group of my ex-lovers to map a problem of space, but not the problem that involved the anxiety of whether they could or could not draw, nor the problem that asked how it was even possible to translate problems into lines. We got thrown off course when I had to yell above the insistence of another that the line was the base of all communication and not the point, as she fiercely argued. While I felt compelled to agree with her, the point certainly did take up less space than the line and seemed to be the originary gesture of all movement. I did have to counter that though the point may be the base of all communication, it could not function as the base, because most people did not begin looking at points until they became lines. We were having a picnic in the park, perched on a small hill, our bodies arranged around an old pink sheet from the 70s, decorated with a blood-red stripe. This was a time of the summer where Brooklyn had become a regular destination for me, and I was turning 40. I was turning 40, so I felt that my ideas were very potent. Every time I found myself leaving an era at the same time that I was entering a new one, which is not always how it happens. Sometimes something big ends and absolutely nothing follows for a long, long time, except maybe you get fat or your sweet dog dies. But on the occasion of going from 39 to 40, well, it was one of those things where everyone filled in your sentences for you. You say something like, I'm turning 40 on Monday, and people, regardless of the degree of intimacy between you, began to tell you a story about themselves or a stranger or about you yourself. And yes, their stories did approximate some of what you've been thinking over the past weeks, but why wouldn't they let you tell it? Impossible when it was a small picnic and you were among your dearest, and one of them was nowhere near 40, and one was quite generously past 40, and the last was just kind of dragging some years behind you. And every time you wanted to say something serious about these eras you were exiting and entering, you kept getting interrupted by the name Hannah Morgenstern, because no one there knew whether she was a real person or a code name used by one of your ex-girlfriends who was not in attendance and didn't like you anymore. So you let everyone else tell you about turning 40 as the Sauvignon Blanc did its thing in the cooler bag and tasted amazingly of grapefruit. You would never be 40 again, someone had just brilliantly told you. It was as if they thought it would harm you to tell your story about it. Just a few more of these. I began the day in a ceramic studio. I wasn't writing. I was decidedly not writing. Even as I held this pen in my hand, I swore I wouldn't write. I didn't. The ceramicist was crazy. She couldn't remember her colors. Her glazing was out of control. Was this Randy's red, she was asking, or Love Child? Why hadn't I made a map, she wondered. She was a ceramicist with her creatures in her hands, wanting to glaze them, but the sculptor wanted the right color. I sat there. I was an unofficial go-between, yet neither ceramicist nor sculptor required my services. It became hard to sit in a ceramic studio. Your arm began to hurt. You were doing nothing, and there was this burning and swelling. Nests were accumulating. Only one of them said, "Love, Danielle." All of them had holes at the bottom. She was going to affix them to the gallery wall. Tomorrow she was going to affix them. I had a hard time keeping track. I wasn't writing. I didn't take any notes. It was like nothing was happening but one person whispering and another gasping, but not as part of a conversation and not in response to any apparent event. The sculptor was waiting for the ceramicist. Her arm was tired. A room of so many with no one writing. Night falling, her arm reaching down, grabbing color. I began the day standing at a threshold of time, the beginning of something, the end of something. I had a method of standing that was called art, then writing. The way I stood, I could understand how things could begin and end this way, simultaneously. It was hard to follow these opposing tendencies, especially when you were writing and couldn't see anyway, see anything other than these words appearing on the laptop screen. You were writing about something you weren't looking at. There had been a break. I was saying this on paper. I am not ready for school. I was typing this. Almost a summer had elapsed. I was looking at committee meetings ahead of me and Friday night lights behind. I was looking at the desires of my students. I was saying goodbye to the tourists' insides. I was picturing January. I was picturing September 7th. Aja seemed to be saying I wasn't feeding her. I was typing this. It was still summer. For a moment, Alev Arslan wasn't sure about Istanbul. I could see her threshold between her feet. Rachel Levitsky had a threshold. Martha had just crossed hers. Stacy kept changing her name. We were all trying to end something and finding something new in the process. But we didn't need the one to come out of the other. In fact, it would be better this way. Aja flew to the East Coast to go swimming, but there was a hurricane. Rather than fly back, she sat solidly in the wind. I didn't hear from her for hours. I made cups of coffee. The day was tremendous. I wanted to name all the people who had thresholds between their legs. I made a grand list, but erased it. It took too much paper. It was too much of a who's who list. And I'm going to finish this part of the reading with a somewhat longer piece. So then I'm writing these essays, and then I've a couple of times been asked to write something for a panel or for a book, like a real essay. And now I can only write these kind of essays, so I write these kind of essays for these occasions. So there's a kind of tribute book coming out for the novelist Gail Scott, fiction writer, lives in Montreal, Canadian, who's meant a lot to me. So a lot of the text in here, I'll say I wrote, and then it'll be a sentence from one of her books. I haven't read this out loud, so we'll see how it goes. I'm not going to do this the whole time because, well, that looks weird. So, but I will say I wrote, and I'll try to make some differentiations. I began the day writing several of Gail Scott's sentences on the wall of my living room. For months I had been trying to say something about them, which when I went to say it became layered, thus impossible as an utterance. I had already argued somewhere that one could not express many different things at the same time in the English sentence, and so was not terribly surprised by my failure. I've learned that to think in this language you had to be patient. You had to say one part, like drawing one side of a cube, then say the next part, like drawing another side. And keep on saying and drawing until eventually you made a complex observation and a picture feeling. You had to be okay that it took you 20 minutes to make this multi-level statement, and accept that you hadn't actually scraped the surface yet of what you were really trying to see with your thinking. But when you were alone and no one was listening to you unfold some puzzle of your mind, you wanted back this ability to make a sentence that contained a paragraph for how far-reaching it was, an ability you may never have had, but that your instinct said belonged to you. I was saying you because I wanted to type this essay and draw on my walls in the same instance of 9:15 that morning, Sunday morning. In the center of the mural was the sentence, each time I start, it's as if the memory of the past, the noun, the sentence's beginning, wipes out the present verb. I wrote, the woman sits still. The woman sips her wine. I wrote, in fact, this whole story might be more appropriate on a train. I wrote, it's true also that in waiting the space of melancholy can open too much. I'd memorized these sentences years ago. I wrote, walking across this hotel terrace in the heat is like being in a postcard. I wrote, thinking that the problem with feeling better, calmer is it opens space for the inner anguish under. I wrote, the inner anguish under again. Because it had reminded me of something. The mural was expanding and had now reached my dining area. As long as there were other rooms, it seemed okay to rewrite those words until I understood what was particular about them. I wrote them as if they were geometry instead of a verbal consequence. I saw that the inner anguish under was trying to tell me something about all the sentences I had just written. Really reaching back to that first one. Each time I start about the process through the sentence being wiped out by its own beginning, what the noun said. Suddenly it became impossible for there to be verbs, or rather it happened that the verb was in such a fragile state there could be nothing else around it. There could be no duration. The sentence had to be divided infinitesimally. There was an inner anguish underneath. I resumed writing. I wrote, looking out window, pale blue sky beyond anarchy of chimney pots. I lifted my wrist from the wall and rotated it to release the tension. Then I wrote, below on the sidewalk, the pale man living in basement. I wrote, walking back down, suddenly feeling happy. When old woman in thick black and white sweater asking help. I stopped. I breathed. I wrote, for pushing heavy door open. No sooner falling over threshold with effort thereof. My head hurt. I pulled my arm back, lay it across my chest. A few moments passed. I resumed. When butch bouncer slamming it closed behind, waving us down plush stairs, entering red and white crescent-shaped room, several lesbians dancing. My breath had grown jagged, and I couldn't repair it. These were the shortest sentences I'd ever seen, yet they were not the kind of sentence that allowed you to rest when you reached the end of them. They pointed always to the one up ahead. I was looking at the changing shape of the mural. What I thought was the effect of a strong sun in the middle room of my house was actually another kind of inner anguish in the language. You couldn't write these short sentences now without making paragraphs. Were you building the present? The shadows said so. There were sentences that I didn't know by heart that were written in a notebook in the bedroom. I was worried about entering another reality, which would happen as soon as I left the drawing space. But the mural would not be complete without them, and would never be complete, but would be drastically incomplete without them. If I left the room now, the room with these paragraphs, I didn't know what I would find when I returned. Paragraphs had too much momentum to remain themselves, and really didn't hold content very well. But the walls were holding the paragraphs, and this looked likely to persist for at least a few moments I needed to run out of the room. I went and retrieved the last sentences. There was something dangerous about them. They pushed you off a balcony. They caused fissures in your reading mind. I wrote, and the day's final filtered trace abruptly snuffed by streetlights, so railway flat room indelible in middle, emitting air of stagnant or impregnable into night become casement. I wrote, the skinny deemed dead or disappeared agoraphobe in window opposite. Then, old boat of once amazing fries. I wrote, that uncontrollable contingency once more streaking past keyhole. Then wrote, whirling swarms and electrons. I wrote, acuiting. I wrote, I are surely kneeling on floor and plus placing fingers around your ivory throat. I wrote, Grandpa in number of dreams lately. For a while, I hadn't actually been writing, but doing a transcription that fell in the deep space between drawing and landscaping. I shaped a dreadful loneliness penetrating the stairway and dropped the granite pencils dramatically to the floor. These were many of her sentences, I thought to say. Could that be the story? Okay. So those just go on and on and on. Okay, so I'm going to read a little bit from the Ravikians. And I really like narrative, and I like sentences. But I don't like to read fiction aloud. I find that it's a little boring. So what do you do when you have a novel? So I like to read the parts that feel good in my mouth, which is what I will do, and I apologize if you can't really get a sense of the story from the few parts that I'll read. So this is part two. And what is no longer a trilogy, because there's about five books that I'm working on about this this place, Ravika, which is far but not too far away. You all should go. Well, times are tough there, but it's still a beautiful place to visit. So I'm going to read a little bit from that. I'm going to read it in English just so that you guys can follow along. To say you have been born in Ravika, in any other language than Ravik, is to say you have been hungry, I should say. This is a first-person account from the great Ravikian novelist Luswa Jamini. So that's this section of the novel is called The Great Ravikian Novelist. She has a book coming out soon in the U.S. Look for it. It's called Morelia. To say you have been born in Ravika in any other language than Ravik is to say you have been hungry. That is why this story must not be translated. If, for example, you are reading these lines in French or German, Basharak, or English, these are not the lines you are reading. Rather, these are not the lines I wrote. Of course, I do not wish to undermine the dexterity of my translators. I have heard they are competent. It is that the things I am trying to say are internal. The interior is twofold. Ravika is not well, and its recovery has everything to do with architecture. Our governor, Ludak Vlati, sings the city's praises. We are against him. While I also adore our city, we are not against me. The difference is the buildings between us. That I can still say buildings shows that we have not lost all yet. My city is also my country, not a common occurrence, yet neither is succeeding from a stronghold nation without violence. We have since had violence. Still, in drawing this portrait, it is important to stress that we had not violence then. 3 years after Ravika gained its independence from Bashir, I became an infant in a lap and an amini. I grew up in the center of the city among trains, street vendors, cafes, cigarette smoke, and though at the time I never thought this is a city life I am living, on some level I knew it was important to take note of where I was. I would like to transcribe those impressions here, yet at this moment they resist me. Soon, I think to myself, in the way it is possible to find the place you are looking for by simply moving about outside, so too when in your mind and writing. It seemed that every square of cement of my childhood had persons in it. When you are small, you cannot ignore the heat from large bodies moving around you. Even those that are standing still emanated in some way. I am not a body, I often said as a child, because I believed mine was not big enough. There is the proximity of the adult human body, and then there is the closeness of buildings, the buildings I have always loved. Ravika is not at all silent as they say it is. When I am in the city, I hear everything. When on Bodhi, I hear voices from Shumgata, two blocks away. When those voices cease, I hear the Balsha wind. Very late at night, a single car speeds through the street. I hear its engine shifting gears. I imagine this nightlife of the driver living through insomnia, no doubt. And I think that the questions I send out to her about why she is here come whirling back at me. Who are you with? Who are you ever with? Repeatedly. So Ravika is not at all silent. I close the book I am reading at the illuminated bench when my bus approaches. I am going on a late night ride, and I am not the only one. If this were another time, we passengers could form a club, but club life does not fit with the solitary confinement of this part of our century. We are surrounded and we are alone. The state goes on until something breaks, until there is no more lonely left. Until we are so full and extended with emptiness that there is no place to go with it. And then out of the dark, someone shows up and gets through. Every so often, it'll be a group. The bus is so familiar, it is a person to me. In these streets, we travel our conversations. No, Ravika is no more silent than Berlin is right now, than Times Square in America. It is 4 a.m., even Tokyo would be asleep. But even if you are sleeping, you are making noise. I hear you grinding your teeth, hear you mumbling, oh no, oh no, I hear you swallow. The others will always be important no matter what happens, no matter how these pieces of construction conform to the quality of space surrounding them, the others will be there. Even if I never call their names, mind you, I would never write this story without making it a story of others, though there is mostly static when I reach for them. Rarely does the shape of a city change once it is full of structures. You cannot rearrange the grid. How extraordinary it is that you must know what you want right away. That is, if you are building a functionalist city. Unfortunately, it seems that that is always what you are building, as if anywhere there is government, there must also be rows upon rows of squares. I have seen over many years the surface of squares change, but hardly ever the squares themselves. That is why I have been thinking of the Plusart. This building, constructed years before the despair overtook Ravica, is intact yet remains empty, its name etched onto the facade in the corner as one would find on a painting, says nearly everything. I have studied it etymologically, and though in itself it has no ancient meaning, its parts do when used in other contents, stretching authority, I know, but one has to begin somewhere. You can say, Jahini Puj, I am calm, and people will feel the weight of that. Or he suit Bindam Cesart Bintali. There are fissures in the city, and teams will appear in force. I once took my studies to the buildings 18 days in a row. What I wanted to discover is why on one day the roof of the Plusart appeared to be made of one kind of material, and on the next day of another kind, alternating between glass, steel, and every so often something tar-based. I was able to see the roof because of the taller glass-encased corporate headquarters of our energy provider. Was the roof's fluctuating state the reason the Plusart remained vacant? At first that seemed to be the case, then I noticed that other buildings, for instance the very roof of the energy provider on which I stood, were undergoing similar transformations. I do not think the day I first noticed the change was the day it first happened. There is usually a lot more drama around these occasions. Everything stops, or everything glows, or everything crashes into everything else. It was odd to think that these first times were happening all over the city and were impacting me in some huge way, but I had never been witness to them. Yet it did not seem that these roofs changing as they were caused any interruption in how the buildings themselves were occupied. In fact, the buildings began to seem more ordinary in being in such flux, except for the Plusart, which had something of its own to work out. I'm just going to read one more section. Today is stunning. Things appear to have changed in the days I spent holed in my apartment. The usual yellow has a sidereal look about it, and as I pass through, I am brushing a glitter from my skin. But why talk about the air here if this is a translation you are reading? I will tell you about it, and you will read me saying the word yellow and think to yourself, science fiction. Well, perhaps I do have a complaint for my translators, especially those moving from Ravik to English. Why, when I say Dahar, do you say yellow? I know that word. The air here is not yellow. It is Dahar, yellow. If you are engaged in a translation and discover that a quality you need to convey does not exist in your language, the language into which you're moving, do not pick the next best thing. Sometimes you will have to put a zero there. This will indicate a hole. The Ravikians know about this. If you do not acknowledge the ignorance you bear, then the places where you have facility in speaking will seem crowded and dull. This is not new. You need nothing to see something, which is the theory behind white space. Nevertheless, the day is beautiful for one who is returning to her intimates. I walked these same streets almost a week ago, but with my old mentality, without an actual boundary to cross, I will never reach you. I did not arrive anywhere. I passed places that I thought could have been for me. I walked up to their doors, but never entered them. At the market, I thought, this is a logical place to be. But after visiting a few stalls, still empty-handed, I decided that I was not there. I was not at the bank to withdraw money for bills. I did not buy a hammock for my garden. Julie Haras did not meet me at Cafe Balva for an interview. The opening of the C.C. Sundergaard exhibit at Fall Gallery did not occur for me. Nothing has happened for weeks, though I struggled to prove this. People will never believe you are without events, and that is why decay is slow and why it is not devastation. Thank you.
I asked Renee if she would be willing to entertain our questions. She said yes. So.
Happy to. Well, I can't really see.
Hands.
Any questions? Just one, please. Give me one. One question. Yes.
Could you talk about how you prepared for the novel? And
how I prepared for the novel? This novel?
Yeah. The first section that you read.
The questioner wants to know how I prepared for the novel. I was asked to do that. I'm not insane. I did not prepare for the novel. This one, how do you prepare for novel? I guess some people do. They make character files. But I wrote the first novel, which is about, it's like a linguist translator who's traveling through Ravika in search of events, and many things happen to her, but she can't feel them because they don't stick for some reason, because experience is elusive. And then she leaves. And then, but before she leaves, she realizes that the person she really needs to talk to in order to figure out life or the crisis is the great Ravikian novelist. We don't know if she ever meets her, but I was like, yeah. We need to hear from Luswa Jamini. So I started writing that part. But this it's a three-part novel. So the first part, she's sort of talking about Ravika. She kind of sets you up for getting a sense of the place. And then she sets out on this walk that lasts a day in order to arrive at an event, which is a reading by the poet Zeora Lumici. And so the second part of the book is his reading. And then the third part of the book is something that's called Jour de Leisure, which is a walk that happens after social events, where a group of people will sort of set out and have this kind of event adventure in language. So that's the third part of the book. And each part sort of found... I actually think I wrote the second part first. But they sort of found each other. It wasn't really a plan. I find Event Factory is a kind of, it's just one sustained narrative, and I find those really hard to write. I normally write in shorter bits, so it's more of that than preparation. Thank you for your question. Anybody else? Yeah.
Can you talk about what you said, experience is elusive, applies specifically to within Ravika and perhaps a little wider than that.
In what way is experience elusive? And how does it apply to Ravika? I do that, and then I forget to actually connect with the question. So I feel like I think in order for me to write, I have to kind of blow up this idea of being in language is a crisis, like a philosophical crisis, or just a problem. and that there's a struggle to language is so seems so orderly the way that we move from the subject to the verb to the predicate. You know, we enter it with this sense of subjectivity. You know, to say to emit a pronoun or a proper noun, it's as if you know what you're going to say, you know where you're going. And I feel that experience is just a lot more mysterious than that. And the way things happen, the way we think about them, the way we're able to think about them, there's this big sort of fallout when it when you then try to sort of cycle it through language and through the paragraph. So to me, experience is elusive mostly when it's time to write about it or think about it. And for the Ravikians, language is different because they don't just use words, they use their bodies mostly, and they can only really communicate if they are moving their bodies at the same time that they're talking. So you find out more about that in the first book, and it's called Parai. And there's lots of bowing and cartwheels and pliés and all kinds of things that they have to do. And like, I'm writing this in the third book. There's this I don't know, like one of them is, I haven't tried, she's like leaning and her head scares, she's like, let's bet. And she's trying to talk about writing. And like, if you can't go low enough, then you're, instead of saying the sentence, you're saying the paragraph. So the body needs to be pretty flexible in order to communicate in Ravika. But I think that's also a way of maybe storing experience, I would say. So maybe experience is not so elusive for these folks. Any other questions? Yeah. Okay.
I can ask the second one out and you answer the first if you want. The first is, it seems like a lot, I've been following you for a long time, and it seems like
I knew there was someone.
I was thinking like that underpinning a lot of the experience or characterization is anxiety, but it's not anxiety, it's like apprehension.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk, do you agree, and if you agree that apprehension is at the base of some sort of identifying, could you talk about that as it works through your books?
Is anxiety the core of
the self? But it's not anxiety because it has to do with...
but perhaps it's not anxiety.
Apprehension.
I would say loneliness.
Really?
Yeah. I would say that my characters are often outside and they just want to make a connection, and that it's really hard to connect, and in confusion, which is maybe where the edginess part comes in that makes you want to say apprehension. But confusion and loneliness perhaps creates a kind of apprehension. But you're lonely, you just want to find that person or those people, but there's so many obstacles, either in language or on the road or in the city changes, and you can't find the door that you're looking for. But I would say that it's usually those two things. Because I sort of feel very isolated in the world. So I'm usually sort of, my characters are usually trying to figure out how to make sense of it or how to get out of it, how to change it. Second question. Has technology affected my relationship to the page? Mm-hmm. No. It's that's a really interesting question, but I'm just so boring. I just love the text block, and it hasn't changed. I started writing something that has, I broke some lines, so it looks kind of like a block cut in half. But yeah, it hasn't really, which is probably not a good thing. Although drawing has become of interest to me in terms of the page and in terms of writing. And I'm really trying to figure out, for teaching and writing, how to have a kind of translation going on where a drawing can be sort of inserted or set into a text and do a kind of thing, but not as an illustration, but as a kind of a mode of expression or a continuance or a way of talking about something or seeing something that you can't really get at through words or something. But yeah, I don't know technology for the page, not so much. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, Sandra.
I really like the translation bits, the kind of meta translation in the work. And I was wondering, aside from Ravika, have you ever translated?
No. Although I'm working on my dream is I'm sort of learning Turkish, and I'm learning Turkish because there's not enough Turkish literature in translation in the U.S. So, but then I get distracted, and so I don't know if that will ever happen. But no, I haven't. I have not gone from one language to another language except for inner English and outer English, I would say. Yeah. Yes?
Mm-hmm. I really actually like a repetition in poetry and other kinds of words for Rob. It's interesting to hear you use it at the start of all those poems.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I a couple of questions related, you can answer them in whatever way makes sense to you. So what is it that repetition allows for you when you return to that phrase?
Mm-hmm.
How does it, and how does the fact of returning to that phrase give you a sense of maybe the pieces change over time and relationship to that return and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then just, I guess, the last question is more just entirely specific. Has the series been going on for a while? Is it still ongoing?
Mm-hmm.
What's the, how do you feel like it develops a piece like that that involves that return to a mind like that?
The series has, I started it in April, and I started it because I decided to stop writing. I kept deciding that I felt done with writing because I didn't really wasn't feeling connected to the novels, and I felt that I didn't know what I was supposed to do with language at this point. I still don't exactly know. Something big seems to be happening. So I do this thing where I say, okay, I'm gonna stop writing, and then the next day I start writing. So that was a part of that. But the question about repetition, how the repetition affects the piece or how it's related to the piece, to me, what's the most important thing about Calamities is that it's really just trying to capture the sense of the day and how the day is followed by another day and all these little things that happen that are kind of unponderable in a way. I mean, that's the calamity part, is that every day there's just these little things like cleaning the espresso maker, wanting to, but like doing all these other things instead, that for some reason I started to realize that there were, I don't know, that I needed to think about them in some way. So the beginning of the day is kind of setting up a rhythm of just the sort of mundane repetition of days. But then I start somewhere and then kind of spiral out and usually get some place that's interesting or useful for me. So when I say that these are about nothing, they are in a way, but they help me. I really feel like they help me sort of be in the present in a way I haven't been able to be before. So I began the day just... I began it. I entered it. I didn't stay in bed. Or I didn't stay asleep. Anybody else?
Maybe one more question.
Yeah.
I had two questions.
Okay.
The first one was how you came across the yellow air.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was, what were you reading when you wrote Event Factory?
What was I reading when I wrote Event Factory? Samuel R. Delaney's Dahlgren. Thank you. I read it and I was like, it's not that I knew that city, but I knew that I had a city in me that needed to be talked about that was strange and beautiful, and I wanted to explore it. I can't remember what the yellow air.
Was it Lynn Hagenian talking about the sky in Russia?
No, it wasn't.
Are you sure?
Yeah. I think. I don't know.
Class together.
Oh my God, but that was 800 years ago.
Well, yeah.
No. Okay. I mean, maybe it was because it was 800 years ago and it became a part of me. But I don't know. I feel like it may have had something to do with that book, and maybe the way that he described his city, which Delaney is he's known as a fantasy and sci-fi writer, but there's nothing particularly sci-fi about this book except that something's wrong, people have left, and maybe it's like post-apocalyptic, but you don't hear about that stuff. You just are dealing with the city afterwards. And maybe there's something in the description that felt like the place was kind of dusty, I don't know. But yeah, this, and then we don't know if it's yellow, if it's Dahar, because, you know, that whole thing, I don't know if it's yellow. I don't know if that's the right word, and I haven't met the translator, so. Did I answer both your questions? I did, okay. Thank you all. It's really a pleasure to be here.